Okay, so ready to dive into another deep dive?
Always.
This time, we're tackling a case that's had a huge GE impact on how juries are chosen, even today.
Batson v. Kentucky, a total game changer.
From 1986, but still SO relevant. This Supreme Court decision really took aim at racial discrimination in jury selection.
Which, let's face it, goes right to the heart of whether we have a fair justice system or not.
Couldn't agree more. We're going to break down what happened in Batson itself.
And how it led to this thing called a Batson challenge. It's a tool lawyers use now all the time.
Exactly. And then we'll look at where things stand and now W, because the fight for impartial juries, well, let's just say it's not over yet.
Not by a long shot.
Right. So to really understand Batson, we got to go back a bit further in legal history.
Before Batson, there was Swain v. Alabama, made it almost impossible to prove racial discrimination was happening when picking a jury.
Really? How so?
Under Swain, you couldn't just point to what happened in your own case. You had to show a pattern of bias from that same prosecutor, but across tons of cases.
Yikes. Talk about an uphill battle.
It was practically impossible to meet that standard, which is where Batson v. Kentucky comes in. James Kirkland Batson was charged with burglary and receiving stolen goods.
Okay.
And during jury selection, get this, the prosecutor uses peremptory challenges to remove all four black potential jurors.
Wait, those are the challenges where you don't have to give a reason, right?
Exactly. So there's Batson facing trial for these charges, and he ends up with an all-white jury.
And I'm guessing that didn't go well for him.
You guessed it. He's convicted, but his lawyers see a huge yee-ee problem here and appeal.
Makes sense. They're basically saying, hold on, you can't just kick off all the black jurors without a good reason.
Exactly. They argued that striking jurors based solely on race violates Batson's right to equal protection under the 14th Amendment.
A cornerstone of our legal system.
Absolutely. And this case, it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. Now the justices, they've got some serious questions to grapple with.
Okay, lay them on me. What were the big issues at stake?
First, does removing potential jurors solely because of their race actually violate the Equal Protection Clause?
Right. Because on the one hand, you've got these peremptory challenges that are supposed to give each side some leeway.
And on the other hand, you can't have a system where people are excluded just because of their race.
Exactly. So, what was the second big question?
Should the Supreme Court ditch that super strict standard from Swain v. Alabama, the one that made it nearly impossible to prove discrimination?
Ah, I see. Because if they kept that standard, it'd be really tough for Batson to win his appeal.
Exactly. So, what did the Supreme Court decide? Well, they sided with Batson. Big time.
Wow, so they said using race as the only reason to strike a juror is a no-go.
A resounding NO. And to make sure this actually gets enforced, they created a new test to help figure out if discrimination happened. It's what we now call the Batson test.
Okay, this is getting interesting. Let's break it down. How does this Batson test work?
It's a three-step process. First, there's something called establishing a prima facie case.
Uh-oh, legal jargon alert. What does that even mean in plain English?
Basically, the defendant has to show they're part of a protected group, like a racial minority in this case, and that the way the jurors were struck raises some red flags about possible discrimination.
I see. So, like, if all the black jurors were struck, that'd be a pretty big red flag.
Right. It's not super hard to clear this first step.
Got it. So, what happens if the defendant manages to raise these initial concerns?
We move to step two. Now the pressure is on the prosecutor.
Okay, what do they have to do?
They have to explain why they struck those jurors, but the reasons can't be about race.
So, what kind of explanations are we talking about here?
It could be anything that seems race neutral. Maybe the juror seemed hostile, maybe they knew the defendant or the victim, maybe their answers were confusing.
Interesting. So the reasons don't necessarily have to be good reasons, just not about race.
Exactly. And that's where things get tricky.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Because how do you prove what someone's real motivation is?
Right. Which leads us to step three of the Batson test. Now it's the judge's turn. They have to look at all the evidence, hear from both sides, and decide.
Decide what?
If the prosecutor's reasons for striking those jurors seem legit, or if they're just hiding actual racial bias.
Whoa, that's a tough job. How can a judge ever be 100% certain?
You've hit on one of the ongoing challenges of Batson. Spotting hidden bias is really, really hard.
It's like trying to read minds. And what happens if the judge does decide the prosecutor was being discriminatory?
Then they can throw out those strikes and even reset the jury selection process.
Wow, so Batson had some real teeth.
Absolutely. And the impact of this decision, well, let's just say it sent shockwaves through the legal world.
So this wasn't just some abstract legal theory. It actually changed how things work in courtrooms across the country.
Big time. And that's what we'll explore next, the rise of Batson challenges and how this case from 1986 is still making waves today.
Welcome back. We're continuing our deep dive into Batson v. Kentucky and the fight for impartial juries. And last time, we left off talking about how Batson changed the legal game with something called a Batson challenge.
Right. Lawyers use it to call out potential bias in jury selection, but Batson wasn't the end of the story.
Definitely not. And that's where Flowers v. Mississippi comes in. You mentioned this case briefly before the break.
Yeah, Flowers really highlights how the issues Batson tried to fix are still a problem.
Okay, so what went down in Flowers? Give us the rundown.
This case is a doozy. It centers around Curtis Flowers, a black man from Mississippi.
Huh?
And he was tried, get this, 6 times for the same crime.
6 times for the same crime? You're kidding.
No kidding. It's wild. He was accused of murdering 4 people in a furniture store back in 1996.
Wow. And all 6 trials were for that one incident.
Yep. And the sheer number of trials. That's where things get really interesting and where we see the connection to Batson.
I am all ears. Tell me more.
Okay. So the first 3 trials, Flowers is convicted each time.
3 convictions in a row.
But there's a twist. Each of those convictions gets overturned.
Why? What happened?
Prosecutorial misconduct. Big time.
Whoa, hold on. What does that even mean?
Basically, the prosecutor, a guy named Doug Evans, he was doing some shady stuff. Tampering with witnesses, hiding evidence, even introducing false testimony. Not cool.
Not cool at all.
Yeah.
So that explains why those first 3 convictions didn't stick.
Right. Now, trials 4 and 5, they're kind of mixed bag. The 4th one ends in a mistrial. Jury couldn't agree.
Hung jury.
Hmm.
Happens sometimes.
But the 5th trial, another conviction. But again, Mississippi Supreme Court steps in and overturns it.
Because of more prosecutorial misconduct.
You got it. And this time it was specifically about how Evans was striking black jurors.
Ah, so here's the tie-in to Batson.
Exactly. They found that Evans was excluding black jurors without any legitimate reason, which, as we know from Batson, is a huge no-no.
Totally. So 5 trials, lots of drama, but still no final resolution.
And then comes trial number 6 in 2010, and guess what? Despite all the previous problems, Flowers is convicted yet again.
No way. He gets convicted a 4th time. This is unbelievable.
And sentenced to death this time.
This is insane. Didn't the defense try to use Batson to stop this?
Of course. They raised a Batson challenge during jury selection. But even with Evans' track record, the trial court accepted his explanations.
Seriously. He somehow convinced them that he wasn't being racially discriminatory.
Yep. The court bought his race-neutral reasons and let the conviction stand.
This is mind-blowing. How could this prosecutor keep getting away with this? It's like the system was failing Curtis Flowers at every turn.
Well, that's exactly why Flowers ended up before the Supreme Court in 2019. Flowers' lawyers, they were determined to get justice for their client.
Okay, so what happened? Did the Supreme Court finally step in and say, enough is enough?
They did. In a 7-2 decision, the court sided with Flowers, reversed his conviction, tossed out the death sentence. It was a powerful moment.
Thank goodness. It feels like the system finally worked the way it's supposed to. But what exactly convinced the Supreme Court that the prosecutor had crossed the line? What made this trial different from the others?
They looked at the whole picture. They didn't just focus on trial number 6 in isolation. They considered Evans's behavior across all the trials.
Ah, so his history of striking black jurors finally caught up with him.
Exactly. The court wasn't buying his excuses anymore. They saw a pattern of discrimination, plain and simple.
That's huge.
Yeah.
But the Flowers case also raises some really tough questions about the Batson test itself.
Yeah, it definitely exposes some of the limitations.
If this prosecutor could manipulate the system for so long, is Batson really enough to protect against racial bias in jury selection?
It's a valid question. Flowers shows us that Batson, while a step in the right direction, isn't a foolproof solution.
Okay, help me understand this. What are the weaknesses of the Batson test? Where does it fall short?
Well, think about it. The test depends on judges being able to spot bias, right?
Right.
But that's not always easy. Even the best judges, they can have implicit biases they're not even aware of. And the test still leaves a lot of room for interpretation.
I see. So even with the best intentions, judges might miss instances of discrimination, or they might be swayed by clever lawyers who know how to work the system.
Exactly. And that's why some legal scholars argue we need to go further. We need to strengthen the protections against bias in jury selection.
So what are some of the ideas out there? How can we make the system better?
Well, some folks are proposing stricter standards for what counts as a race-neutral explanation.
Interesting. What would that look like in practice?
Imagine a rule that says prosecutors can't strike a juror based on a characteristic that's more common in one racial group than another unless they can show a strong reason why that characteristic is relevant to this case.
I like it. That would force prosecutors to be way more specific and thoughtful about their choices.
Right. It wouldn't be so easy to rely on vague stereotypes or flimsy excuses.
Are there other ideas out there, other ways to improve the system?
Definitely. Some folks think judges should have more power to question prosecutors about their motives, like really dig deep and figure out what's going on beneath the surface.
I could see that being helpful. It'd add an extra layer of scrutiny to the process.
Right. And of course, there's always the option that Justice Marshall suggested back in the Batson days.
Oh, yeah, I remember you mentioned that. He was pretty skeptical of peremptory challenges in general.
He was. He thought they were just too open to abuse. His solution, get rid of them entirely.
Wow, that's a pretty radical idea. But I can see how it would address the root of the problem. If lawyers had to justify every strike with a rock-solid reason, it'd be a lot harder to discriminate.
Exactly. But abolishing peremptory challenges is still a very controversial idea.
I bet. There are strong arguments on both sides. So where does that leave us? What's the bottom line from all of this?
I think the bottom line is this. Flowers v. Mississippi shows us that the fight for truly impartial juries is far from over. Batson was a huge step forward, but it's not the finish line.
We need to keep learning from these cases, keep pushing for a better system.
Absolutely. And that's what we'll do in our final part. We'll explore how all of this plays out in one of the most high-profile trials in recent history, the trial of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd.
Oh, wow, yeah. That case was like a national reckoning with race and justice.
Mm-hmm.
And the jury selection process was definitely under a microscope.
It was, and it'll give us a chance to see how Batson is being applied in the 21st century with all its complexities.
Okay, I'm ready. Let's dive into the Chauvin trial. Welcome back to the final part of our deep dive. It's been quite a journey through Batson v. Kentucky and the fight for impartial juries.
It really has. We've covered Batson itself, the Batson test, looked at Flowers v. Mississippi.
Yeah, seen how these issues play out in real cases.
Huh.
And now, like you said before the break, we're going to shift our focus to a trial that really gripped the nation, Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd.
It was impossible to ignore. Such a powerful moment in our national conversation about race and justice.
Absolutely. And the jury selection in the Chauvin trial, it had Batson written all over it.
No doubt. Both sides knew the stakes were incredibly high. Every decision about who would be on that jury was crucial.
Right, because this wasn't just about one police officer, one incident.
Hmm.
It became symbolic of so much more.
Exactly. It put the whole issue of racial bias in the legal system front and center.
Okay, so before we get into the specifics of the jury selection, let's just quickly recap the basic facts of the case for our listeners. Derek Chauvin, a white police officer, was charged with murdering George Floyd, a black man, during an arrest.
In Minneapolis, back in 2020.
Right. And that horrific incident, caught on video, sparked protests all over the country, a real reckoning with racial injustice in America.
It was a turning point. The whole world was watching.
And when the trial finally started, I remember watching the jury selection process and feeling this intense tension. Every potential juror was asked about their views on race, on policing, even the Black Lives Matter movement.
It was clear that both the prosecution and the defense were looking for any hint of bias, any reason to strike a potential juror.
And that's where Batson comes back into play, right?
Yeah.
Because both sides had the ability to raise a Batson challenge if they thought a juror was being struck for discriminatory reasons.
Absolutely. And just to be clear, a Batson challenge isn't only used when minority jurors are being excluded.
Oh, right. You're saying it can work both ways.
Exactly. The point is to prevent any potential juror from being excluded just because of their race. It doesn't matter if they're white, black, Asian, whatever. It's about making sure race isn't the deciding factor.
Got it. So were there any actual Batson challenges in the Chauvin trial? Did either side try to use it?
They did. But there was a bit of a twist. It was actually the defense who raised most of the Batson challenges.
Really? That's interesting. Usually it's the defense arguing that the prosecution is trying to exclude black jurors.
I know, right? But in this case, the defense was claiming that the prosecution was disproportionately striking white jurors.
So they were basically saying the prosecution was trying to create a jury that would be more likely to convict Chauvin.
That was their argument. They thought the prosecution was trying to stack the deck in their favor.
Okay, so what did the judge think about all this?
Yeah.
Did the defense's Batson challenges succeed?
For the most part, no. The judge denied most of those challenges. He found that the prosecution had given good enough reasons for their strikes, reasons that weren't about race.
So the jury selection process continued, and eventually they seated a 12-person jury. And if I remember correctly, it was a pretty diverse group.
Yeah, it was. There were 4 white women, 2 white men, 3 black men, 1 black woman, and 2 multiracial women.
And ultimately, this jury found Derek Chauvin guilty on all charges.
Second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, second-degree manslaughter.
Pretty historic verdict. It's not every day that a police officer is held accountable for killing a black person.
It felt like a turning point for a lot of people, a sign that maybe, just maybe, the system could deliver justice in these cases.
Yeah. But even with the guilty verdict, the Chauvin trial, and the jury selection process specifically, it really exposed how complex these issues are.
Definitely. It left a lot of people wondering if our legal system, even with Batson, is really equipped to deal with racial bias.
It's a tough question. I mean, Batson was a huge step forward,
right?
But cases like Flowers and even the debate around the Chauvin jury show us that we're not there yet.
We're not. There's still so much work to do to ensure that everyone, regardless of their race, gets a fair trial, a trial where the jury is truly impartial.
Yeah. It's a conversation we need to keep having, a fight we need to keep fighting.
Absolutely. And that's what this deep dive has been all about, exploring these issues, understanding the challenges, and hopefully inspiring our listeners to be part of the solution.
Well said. Thanks for joining me on this journey through Batson v. Kentucky and its legacy.
It's been my pleasure.
And to all our listeners out there, keep those legal minds sharp, and let's keep working together toward a more just future.